Fuller's mother refers to her daughter's popular and critically acclaimed memoir, Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight, as that awful book. Published almost a decade ago, it chronicles Fuller's chaotic years growing up in Zimbabwe, where her white colonialist parents' fierce attachment to the land amid the country's civil war was so much a part of the story. It was a riveting read. Fuller's mother was a memorable and powerful presence in that book and plays a starring role in Fuller's new book, Cocktail Hour Under the Tree of Forgetfulness. This memoir focuses on Fuller's parents and how they ended up living in Kenya, Zimbabwe, and now Zambia during this time of dramatic change. And let me say to you, Alexander Fuller, it's a great pleasure to have you with us on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
Well, I'd love to have us all begin with a reading from the very beginning of your book.
Our mum, or Nicola Fuller of Central Africa, as she has on occasion preferred to introduce herself, has wanted a writer in the family as long as either of us can remember, not only because she loves books and has therefore always wanted to appear in them, the way she likes large, expensive hats and likes to appear in them, but also because she has always wanted to live a fabulously romantic life for which she needed a reasonably pliable witness, a scribe. At least she didn't read you Shakespeare in the womb, my sister says. I think that's what gave me brain damage. You do not have brain damage, I say. That's what Mum says. Well, I wouldn't listen to her. You know what she's like, I say. I know, Vanessa says. For example, I say lately she's been telling me that I must have been switched at birth. Really? Vanessa tilts her head this way and that to get a better view of my features. Let me have a look at your nose from the other side. Stop it! I cover my nose. Well, you brought it on yourself, Vanessa says, lighting a cigarette. You should never have written that awful book about her. I count the ways that Vanessa is wrong. For the millionth time, it's not awful, and it wasn't about her. Vanessa blows smoke at the sky placidly. That's not what Mum says. Anyway, I wouldn't know. I haven't read it. I won't. I can't. I'm brain damaged. Ask Mum.
That's a great beginning of a book. She did, and I don't know if she still does, refer to your first memoir as that awful book, but I also got the sense that she loved being in that book as well.
I don't think so. No, she was appalled. The things that appalled her about being in that book weren't the things that would appall most American mothers. Most American mothers would be horrified if their daughter wrote about them being so drunk that not only did they not even closely resemble their passport photo, but they have to be wrapped in a tarpaulin and thrown in the back of a pickup to make the border crossing between Zambia and Zimbabwe because they can no longer sit up in the passenger seat.
So that wasn't a problem for her?
Not a problem. The problem, and nor actually, was my mother as worried as most people would be that I had displayed her bigotry in all its, you know, uncensored unglory. I think the thing that really challenged my mother was that the book undid the myth of herself, which was this veneer of unbelievable toughness, which isn't to say that toughness doesn't go to the core. But what it spoke about was that there had been loss in our family, and that behind closed doors, my mother grieved the loss of her children physically and deeply and all the way down to her soul. And yet when she walked out of those doors, the impression I think that she wanted to give the world was that she was okay.
And we should say that we're talking about the death of three children.
The death of three of her five children.
Yeah,
correct.
One dying in childbirth, one dying of meningitis, and one drowning.
Yeah.
As little children.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think the thing that this Cocktail Hour addresses was that my mother said, challenged me after dinner, let's go to the dogs tonight. She said, you know, you don't actually know me. You have written a book about your experience of me, but you don't know who I am. You don't know what my motivations are. You don't even know where I'm from. And I said, that's fair enough. I did that thing that reporters do, which is I actually interviewed my mother.
Hard to imagine.
Well, the interviews didn't go well.
I think she would be hard to interview as someone who interviews for a living.
Well, I went to Scotland to do the interviews. I wanted to be in the country where it was illegal to have armed weapons close at hand.
And we should say to people who haven't read these memoirs that your parents are largely armed in this first in the first memoir.
Armed and unafraid of alcohol. And the combination of the two. So, you know, being in Scotland's I thought would be sort of neutral territory. And I did hours and hours and hours of interviews with her, but my sort of abiding memory of the feeling surrounding those interviews was that it was a eugenics lesson. My mother telling me, you know, I have 200 bazillion% Scottish Highland blood, which makes me purer than anyone, and you were either switched at birth or, you know, there's a rumour of Armenian blood on your father's side, and I think it all got distilled in your body because no child of mine would have done this disloyal thing. And so I put the tapes away. I didn't really actually want to go back and listen to them. And then a couple of years ago, I got whooping cough, which, unless you have a pre-existing condition forbidding it, I highly recommend.
Really?
Yeah, it's great. You sound so sick. No one comes anywhere near you. You'll get all your reading done. I did get all my reading done because you're sick for about 100 days. And then I thought, well, maybe I should bring those tapes down and listen to them. And it turns out that a degree fever of about 101 degrees is the perfect remove with which to hear my mother.
And the voice that you just said, that is what your mother sounds like.
You know, and her, we sound so similar that on the tapes, when I was listening to the recording, the only way that I could distinguish between us is that she is so politically incorrect that she makes Sean Hannity look like Oprah. So you can tell it's her speaking versus my rather astonished answers.
Well, she was born, her family is from Scotland, and she says she's 1,000,000% Scottish. But also in your family, there is a family war cry. And as you say, you know, what family has a war cry? But apparently hers...
What family needs a war cry? Well,
exactly. But hers, I don't know, did they need one? They certainly had one.
My mother certainly has the attitude.
And what is that war cry?
Well, her unofficial war cry was, "Ole, I am a bandit." But her family war cry was "Gainsay who dare."
Gainsay who dare.
Mm-hmm.
Meaning?
You're either for me or against me. Yes.
Sound like your mother?
That would be my mother. And so she organized, after I'd written "Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight," which I really did think it was a memoir. I didn't think it was a biography of her. I wasn't brave enough to do a portrait of her. She organized sanctions against me or a boycott that was, you know, anyone sort of south of the equator or north of the Limpopo was forbidden from speaking to me. And my mother learned about sanctions and boycotts from the Rhodesians, so she was quite good at it.
And this was to punish you for having written this
awful book. And the other thing was, right before I had written the book, I actually became an American citizen. And so my mother, that gave her a sort of way to speak about me. So she didn't actually have to dissociate herself completely from me, because what she could say to people was, well, this is my other daughter, the American one. You do be careful. She tends to write tell-all memoirs about how she wasn't cuddled enough as a child.
Wow. What's so interesting is that, you know, as a writer, what a wonderful person to write about, right? But as a daughter, to have a mother who's so judgmental and maybe uncuddling. You know, I'm looking at you as I'm describing a mother that I only know through your books. But what I'm saying is, on the one hand, you have this amazing character to write about. On the other hand, she's your mother.
So I think that the work of a writer is to... remove from yourself, before you sit down and write, the self-protective labels that keep the world from being in your soul. Mm-hmm. We all have a whole heap of those labels. So I had ripped off quite a lot of them. The book before this one had been about a Wyoming cowboy. And that had to really get and enable him to embody me so that I could properly hear him. Mm. I had to remove the labels of feminist, vegetarian, liberal, you know, a host of ways that I would, that protection would have stopped me from hearing him, so that the quality of my listening could shift in a way that I could actually hear what it is he needed to say, not what I thought I wanted him to say through, you know, whatever agenda I have.
You could do that with your mother?
The very stickiest label of all, it turned out, was daughter.
Which means that it's, what, next to impossible to...
No, I think I ripped it off, but boy, it hurt.
Yeah.
And then I can hear her. You know, if I was writing about her as her daughter, then she became a list of all the things she wasn't. She wasn't pampering. She wasn't coddling. She wasn't protective. But if I took the label of daughter off and saw her for what she was, then what she was someone that I could admire with absolutely knee-buckling awe. Going beyond the place of judgment and even beyond the place of compassion to go, here is a woman who is uncensored, utterly unafraid of herself, completely in her own myth, really. I mean, she has created a narrative of herself and she stuck to that storyline pretty firmly. So she may have not been a good mother as a child, but she has been a wonderful role model to a woman going into her 40s, as I am.
Well, that's interesting. But did you, and do you... feel any way protective of her from readers like me? I mean, people that don't, you know, we read your book and we have a judgment perhaps about your mother, about your life. I mean, we're both intrigued, but we're saying, oh my goodness, they did that, they drank that much, for instance.
Well, I mean, I think this is a cliche to say this, but I have no control over what a reader brings to the book, and very often the judgment that a reader brings to a book is their work, certainly not mine, and it's certainly not my mother's. She's doing her work regardless of how people read her. So I don't feel protective of her from that point of view. There's nothing you can do about that. I did, however, have this moment writing the book, listening to her, where I wanted to do the impossible thing, which was to reach back through the years and stop what was going to happen next.
Meaning?
There's this moment when she was barely 23, 24 years old, and she has lost her son. And he's, you know, she walks out of the hospital where he's died of meningitis, and it's October, so the jacaranda are in bloom. In Meikle Square, the flower sellers are selling agapanthus. There's that October clouds roiling on the horizon, and my mother says, and the world was carrying on. But I didn't know how it could, because for me, the world had stopped. The time that I was hearing my mother say those words, really listening to her with this quality of listening, I was almost old enough to be a mother to the woman that she was when she lost that child. And I knew that she was going to go on and lose two more children, a war, several farms, and ultimately her mind.
Has she read this book?
She has read this book.
And what does she call it?
Another awful book.
Does she?
Babe has written another awful book.
Is that now a compliment?
You know, at some point you just have to take everything my mother says as a compliment.
Let's take a very short break. We'll get back to our conversation talking with Alexandra Fuller. She has a new book called Cocktail Hour, Under the Tree of Forgetfulness, and in many ways a prequel to her first book, a memoir called Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight, about growing up in Zimbabwe and her parents and their life and farming and the country's civil war. We'll take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Supporting WHYY, Westchester University offers over 150 undergraduate and graduate programs, including programs in the arts and research opportunities such as the Amazon Center for Environmental Education and Research and the Heat Institute, dedicated to conducting independent research related to the treatment of heat-related illness in athletes. More details are available at wcupa.edu. That's wcupa.edu.
At the heart of everything we do at WHYY is one thing: storytelling. We try to inform, engage, inspire, and connect through deep, colorful stories. And NewsWorks Tonight brings together the best reporting from our network of journalists in one smart, lively regional news magazine. Weeknights at 6 on WHYY-FM, or listen online at WHYY.org and NewsWorks.org. There's also the podcast, and you can follow NewsWorks Tonight on Twitter and Facebook. And that's the story.
Lancaster City Arts is proud to support WHYY. Lancaster City Arts, 125 art venues, all within one walkable community. From galleries, art studios, museums, and an art college, to music, poetry, dance, photography, professional theater, and symphony, it's an opportunity to experience something different in an art scene that's quite unexpected itself. Lancaster City Arts. The journey starts online at lancasterarts.com.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen talking with Alexandra Fuller. You may have read her memoir, came out a couple of years ago, called Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight, a popular and critical success about her childhood growing up in Africa, largely in Zimbabwe, a sad and at times funny, tragic, deeply moving story of her family. One of the most memorable characters was her mother, Nicola. Well, her new book is a prequel of sorts called Cocktail Hour Under the Tree of Forgetfulness, also about her parents and her family. Her parents do now live in Zambia under one of those trees. And Alexandra Fuller, our guest today on Radio Times. Any questions you might have about either of these books, do give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. So as you say, and oftentimes in this book, she's referred to as Nicola Fuller of Central Africa.
Gave herself that name.
Which could be a title in and of itself, yes?
Well, you know, the idea that my mother would have such a strong sense of self. I mean, what if she has 10 commandments, the first one would be, if in doubt, wear an ascot hat. The second one would be, live your life as if it were going to be a biography or an opera and accordingly have a soundtrack. And a title, and she did that. I mean, she has this absolute exuberance, this complete curiosity. My 18-year-old daughter recently went to Africa to stay with my parents. It's the first time that she's gone there without, you know, me playing a sort of protective role.
Yes.
So my daughter came back and shaking her head and said, "My God, you underwrote that woman."
She's that powerful a person.
Well, and she had taken my daughter and several of my sister's children. As my mother says, my sister has produced a litter of children. So she is taking this litter of children on a death march, which I'd warned Sarah about. But my mother's a big believer that children and dogs require plenty of fresh air and exercise, so you get marched off on one of these death marches. And there was a baobab tree with a great big hole in it. And Mom said, we should go and explore that tree. It was very interesting. I think something might be nesting in it. And they get up, and sure enough, there's a bee's nest, actually, and the bees are beginning to swarm, which I think is fairly sort of iffy anywhere. But in Africa, it's really not good. So Mom sees this, and she grabs her dogs, and she swats her grandchildren to the ground and flees for the Tree of Forgetfulness, leaving my daughter as the eldest grandchild to pick up the remaining granddaughters. And when my daughter confronted her with her, she said, grandchildren, easy come, easy go. However, karma being what it is, my mother was the only person who got stung, and she's quite allergic to bees, and her face swelled up, and she was thrilled. She says, "Look at that. I don't have a single wrinkle on the side of my face. It's nature's Botox. I look fabulous. I wonder if I can go down to the tree and persuade them to sting me on the other side of my face." And Sarah just said, she is so irrepressible. She overrides everything. You can't really be in the same room with her and share space.
Do you think she loves her dogs more than her children and grandchildren?
Well, I will say something about my mother. She's managed to be incredibly racist at the point of taking it to a sort of science, really, but she's not speciesist. So she doesn't really think that dogs are a lower or lesser species than humans. In fact, very often I actually would argue that animals are, in fact, elevated far beyond humans. And you know what? As her daughter, there's a point at which you accept that. The great gift, I think, of being raised with someone like that is you're under no illusions or disillusions that you're in any way special. When you get flung out into the world, you are just another soul among souls. It's not that I don't think she loves me at all, I think. I mean, I think she does love her children. I just think she has this kind of capacity to truly love animals.
Well, what's interesting is, as you say, she is a racist, and I would have to say, reading about her, she certainly comes across that way. she names her dogs things like Che. I mean, she names them for revolutionaries, but she's a colonialist.
Well, she did also name a dog Papa Doc.
That's true.
Fair.
That's
yeah.
true. Mm-hmm. But nonetheless, it sort of, she has a very colonial view of Africa, wouldn't you say?
Well, I would say this one. When my parents were being raised, they're both British, even though my mother was raised in Kenya. I think the sort of view then of being British was that if you were British, that was fantastically lucky for you. And if you weren't British, then your culture was just a failed attempt at being British. And if you would just allow yourself to be colonized, everything would turn out fabulously for you.
Oh, my goodness.
And you know, I think that was a very deadly attitude. And I mean it in every sense of the word. I don't just mean deadly, obviously, for the millions and millions of people who were oppressed by that kind of thinking, but it was deadly, too, for the people who were doing the oppressing. Very hard to concentrate on much else when you are so busy squashing this sort of, you know, the powers that you consider are beneath you, which, of course, they never are. There came a moment in my parents' life when they were in their late 50s when they had lost everything. They had lost the wars. They had lost children. My sister and I had left home. They did not even have a roof over their heads. Somebody had lent them stay in a little cottage outside of Lusaka. And my mother had most catastrophically lost her mind. And my father did something that I can really only express as a vision quest. Took a packet of cigarettes, walked out on the Zambezi escarpment ridge, and sat there overlooking the valley for a couple of days until the answer came to him. And he came back and said to my mother, "Africa is for the Africans. We've done this wrong."
And what was her response?
She said, "Okay. Then we are Africans, so be it. And so now how do we go forward? Having fought, having used up so much energy and sweat, having spent so much blood on being British in Africa, to now accept your Africanness and everything that that means, that you will be buried here, that you will go down as an African in every way. To accept that was a kind of profound peace."
Did they live differently as a result of that?
Did
they see their black African neighbors differently because of that?
I think that shift had already started. Probably, I would say in the early 80s, I would say that shift had already started to happen. I mean, there's a point at which it's ridiculous to keep on striving in your whiteness. So that had changed. And my mother is, she's very, very, very widely read. Look, she is such a complicated person. She, amongst her favorite authors are black African writers, particularly from East Africa, Ngugi Wa Thiong'o. She's a massive fan of his work. And so she has the ability to read that work and to feel this great connection and compassion. And yet this fragile, brittle outer self of her insisting on this Britishness, I think, was a fight that was almost killing her. So to finally accept her Africanness, I think, was a relief. What it took for my father was a visit to the headman and to say to him, "I am your subject. I require some land for these uses." And the headman said, "Okay, come back with a pair of size 6 pairs of tackies." So my father did that and came back 18 times and sat under a mango tree and waited and waited, as you do in that particular culture in the Scoba Valley. You don't assert yourself. You wait until the headman sees that it is right for you to have this land. And so at that point, my parents were so poor that they actually qualified for 2 free donkeys from the Minister of Zambian Agriculture.
Let me just quickly reintroduce you. And again, Alexandra Fuller is our guest today on Radio Times. We are talking about her family, and she has written 2 books about them. The first one came out almost 10 years ago, a memoir called Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight. And she's got a new book called Cocktail Hour Under the Tree of Forgetfulness, and it's about her memorable family, their colonial past, living in a country racked by civil war. And we are talking about both the experiences that they had and some of the after effects as well. And we're taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. You also say, and there's this deep connection they have to land in where they have lived in Africa. Land is mom's love affair, and it is dad's religion. What do you mean by that?
Well, I think that their marriage, which is wildly successful, has
always...
In spite of everything, right? Well, maybe because of everything, has always been a bit of a love triangle, in that at the center and heart of it has been their shared passion for land. For my father, land, there is something sacred to it, the way that he paces it, that he, it's compulsive for him to be in a place and to feel the need to stand unshod upon the earth, to smell it. And you can see, I know him well enough, that he's calculating that soil's capacity to hold water, or he can feel its need for nitrogen, or for, you know, and he would know what to plant in that soil. And so for him, it is a very organic thing. And he's just turned 70, and so he's been banging on about the fact that he's had a 3 score year and 10, and that's it. He's not going to bat some other chap's innings, and that's not cricket. So he's planning to die any minute. And my sister, who really is sort of functionally illiterate, was a bit panicked about this. She really does refuse to read, and which is why my mother read her the complete works of Shakespeare. Well, Vanessa was still in the womb, and it put her off reading and writing forever.
So let me just stop you there. So your sister, you think, actually is functionally illiterate?
Well, she hasn't read my books.
Okay. And she's getting back in
there.
Okay,
you go. Okay, but okay. She also has her ability to use words. Her vocabulary is usually more colourful than it is accurate. So she says, well, Dad's planning to kick the bucket. Well, I don't know. I can't stand up at the funeral and do his urology. You better do it. And Dad has said when he dies, and that what he wants is to be, in the part of Africa where I'm from, if you are of the very poorest person, you're so poor you can't even afford a cardboard coffin, you will be just wrapped in a piece of black cloth, and in the stores where that cloth is sold, it's called sari cloth, because it is used only for that purpose, to wrap bodies of the very poorest. And that is what my father would like, to have nothing but sari cloth between him and his body when he is laid beneath his baobab tree.
Pretty powerful.
Deep enough so that Mum's dogs won't.
Well, I was going to say, and just to add to that, and she, on the other hand, and this is of course getting ahead of the story, she wants this lavish funeral.
Right, sing the Hallelujah chorus, fling yourself into the grave after me. Yeah, everyone has to wear an ascot hat.
Does that tell you then something about your parents, or tell us something about your parents?
Well, you know, I don't think my mother's without irony, and I think that the you know, particularly since the first book was written, and I think she has seen herself. I mean, she's an incredibly intelligent woman. She often now will say something that I know for effect, for shock effect, and I can see this sort of slightly mischievous look on her face that she's saying it just because she thinks it's going to make a good line in another awful book.
Written by her awful daughter, right?
The one that was switched at birth.
But your father seems stoic, quieter. And there's also a picture of them. I don't know if they are quite married yet, but they certainly mm-hmm. are. It's in the beginning of their relationship, and they married pretty quickly, mm-hmm. it seems. But it's such a sexy picture. I mean, they look so, they're kind of lying next to each other and laughing and looking very engaged.
You know, I think that they have an absolute compatible physicality, and they both extremely sort of earthy people. They both loved horses and anything to do with them, and they both love being outside, and I think they both have a very sort of physical way of experiencing the world. My mother is more vocal. She's not any more vocal. She sing to you at the drop of a hat, and she, her sort of experience of herself is a quite sort of chattering presence. My father is, and I think that this was a certain class of British man raised in his time, were raised very much with the philosophy of Stoicism. I mean, literally Marcus Aurelius and the Meditations, that the duty of one's life is not to be controlled by your emotions at all, that to simply let your emotions wash through you, and to die a good death when the time came.
Which is, of course, that British stiff upper lip, right? To don't be vulnerable?
Yes.
How did they meet?
Well, my father grew up in, as my mother says, at the damp, boiled cabbage-smelling hell of England, and just couldn't wait to get out. He'd been raised, I know, with a fair amount of material comfort and a icy emotional landscape. And so I think for him, a physical urge to get somewhere warm and away from, I think, the way that the English had, you know, in the 50s were sort of in their little isolated separateness and this kind of locked down chilliness that came after the war, the rations, you know, I mean, things were still being rationed then. So he went to Canada and that was really cold.
Not exactly the right direction if you want to get warmer, right?
Found himself in the West Indies, really enjoyed that. It was fairly alcoholic, lots of rum punches, and then found a job in East Africa. And he said, well, I always wanted to see a giraffe. He wasn't planning to stay. He got the job. He arrived in Kenya 2 or 3 weeks after the beginning of independence. And he had a job on the wattle plantation. He was sent to the airport to pick somebody else up. He can't remember who that person was now. But what he saw getting off the aeroplane was my mother, who had been sent to finishing school in London in the vain hope that she'd learn. They tried to civilize me and teach her how to type. She absolutely refused. But she got off the aeroplane, and my dad said, you've just never seen anything like it. She took your breath away. And you can tell, even now, she still astonishes him, not so much with her beauty, but with her courage. The bravest woman I have ever met.
And that would be how he describes her.
Mm-hmm.
And that counts something for him, right?
Enormously. And she never gave up on me, he'll say. Anybody else would have given up on me.
They got married pretty quickly, right? But after
my mother says, well, we were forced to have a very long engagement. Turns out I did the calculation. It was 6 months. I said, but I think it was such an instant connection. I think truly they are soulmates. So for them, I think 6 months did feel like an inordinately long time.
And spent the early part of their life in Kenya.
And I think my mother thought she would never leave Kenya. I think it was absolutely, she knew that she was having this heavenly sort of childhood, and it was very cinematic. I mean, I think she's always had this sense of herself from the outside. In an odd way, she has a writer's mind in the way that she is already making a story out of something before it's happened. And it being in her wake was very interesting. Following her around as a child, I would witness our day happen. And I would see it. And then I would come home at night. And then I would witness her telling my father about the day. And I would see that magic, the alchemy of story, that, oh, this is how you distill a day down into complete paragraphs and into a way that makes it amusing. So I think even as a child, she had that. And so in that early narrative of herself, the idea of leaving Kenya had not occurred to her.
Mm. But your family does, and we're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. And again, Alexandra Fuller is our guest today on the show. We are seesawing between two of her memoirs. The first one, Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight, memoir about our guest's chaotic years growing up in Zimbabwe. Also, her parents' fierce attachment to the land, and she has a new memoir largely about her parents. It's called Cocktail Hour Under the Tree of Forgetfulness. We're going to take a very short break and then get back to our conversation. And again, if you've read either of these books and you have a question, do give us a call at 1-888-477-9499. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Penn Medicine supports WHYY. Have you been feeling anxious, worried, on edge? The Integrative Medicine and Depression Research Unit at Penn Medicine is studying the causes and treatment of mood disorders. You may be eligible to participate in a research study looking at the effects of natural supplements to treat the symptoms of worry and anxiety. Initial evaluations determine eligibility for treatment. To learn more about Penn Medicine's Integrative Medicine and Depression Research Unit, 215-662-3462. 215-662-3462.
In the new book, Confidence Men, Wall Street, Washington, and the Education of a President, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Ron Suskind describes rivalries and dysfunction in the Obama White House early in Obama's term. Now some of the people quoted in the book are saying they were misquoted or their comments were taken out of context. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Ron Suskind. Join us.
This afternoon at 3 and again tonight at 7 on WHYY.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Remember clawbacks, getting money back from execs whose companies cooked the books? How's that going? Also, the story of young Japanese women who came to the U.S. as mail order brides and often ended up decades later in internment camps. That's Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, talking with Alexandra Fuller about her books and her family, her life, and again taking calls at 1-888-477-9499. Your mother describes, and in your book is based in many ways on interviews that you had with her, and I guess others as well, your father included, describing, and this is in Kenya, the sort of Happy Valley set. I mean, it seems that she was both sort of part of this set, but not part of this set at all. And she also describes a really horrible, tragic thing that happened to her when she was, I guess, a young woman or even a teenager.
Well, it was her mother came out to Kenya as a governess and was taking care of this awful woman. Her name, my mother's, Inky Porter. And she, you know, my mother has this unbelievable sort of sharp mind to have attached onto these incredible details. And Inky Porter was a white hunter, very bored at finding herself pregnant right in the middle of hunting season. So she carried on drinking gallons of gin and snorting, as my mother says, mountains of cocaine. And when this baby was born, Inky Porter threw it at my grandmother, who was a... My mother and I couldn't quite settle on a word for what my grandmother was, but she was essentially a nanny. And then went off to go hunting and, you know, whatever it was that Inky Porter did. And this baby died of withdrawal in my grandmother's arms. And that forever set my mother against the Happy Valley set. And it was interesting. Until I had written and done this book, I had always sort of felt that my mother, in a way, must have been associated with the Happy Valley set. I mean, she is hard drinking. She's got a lot of those sort of hedonistic characteristics. Oh, we're here right now. Charge on regardless of whatever. But in the narrative of herself and in her own experience, that wasn't what she was. She was much more land attached. She found the White Mischief Happy Valley set. They were just there for the party. They weren't there deeply in love with the land. And they died in hedonistic droves. They weren't there for the long haul. And my mother was all about the long haul. Hmm. And then to sort of hear her talk about the experience of having her children and how perfect they were. This, you know, my sister, who having been read the entire works of Shakespeare in the womb, was supernaturally calm when she when she arrived, this golden child, and my mother carrying on in her golden sort of lit life, painting, and her life was on track to be this thing that she had in mind for herself. It only came unraveled, I think, because they violated a basic rule, which was that they moved down into Rhodesia, which was at that time a rebel country that had set itself apart from the world. And in spite of the world's sort of distress at what Rhodesia was doing, having declared itself unilaterally independent from Britain. And it was that rebelliousness that I think started this tragic train of events. Mm. They went down there knowing... They receded. You know, I think the whites from across Africa either left the continent or they receded further south to countries that were still white-run, South Africa and Rhodesia. And there was a violence in the intention of that act that had a very long half-life. And that became incredibly personal in the instance of my family.
Do you see them? Do you see your parents as tragic?
No.
Heroic?
No.
Troubled?
No. Wow. That's a really good question. I see them as having no regrets. And there is something... So I see them as having the courage of their convictions, however misguided those convictions sometimes were, and that they have seen that there was a terrible cost to those convictions, but they had the convictions nonetheless and have lived with the ghastly consequences of it. Mm. They have paid a tremendous price for their bigotry. Most people don't have to pay for their views and opinions in quite the way that my parents have with blood.
And how do you mean that? I mean, just the way they live their life?
Yes, and I think a lot of people can carry on the sort of rather bigoted, unconscious way. And really, what consequences happen to them? I mean, so some people might not talk to them, or, you know, they may not have a wide circle of friends, or they may be, you know, people roll their eyes at them, or I don't know. But I mean, when your beliefs lead you to a place where then so much tragedy ensues, where you are then forced to fight in a war, where you have to take a stand because of your beliefs, I think a lot of people would be a lot more careful about what they believed in if it meant that for 6 months of the year, for nearly a decade, they had to go into the bush with a gun and fight to defend those beliefs.
Your parents drank. I don't know how much they still... Actually, there's a picture of them under this tree of forgetfulness. Looks like they have a cocktail in their hand. Mm-hmm. Do you think of them as alcoholics? Does that describe their
drinking?
That's a
strong word.
I know it is. And they're different kinds of excessive drinking.
Yeah, well, listen, I think it's in our blood. To be able to hold a fair amount of alcohol. And I think that we have a different relationship to alcohol than a lot of people in this country, for example. I think if you grow up in Africa, it's not an unacceptable way to deal with what the world is throwing at you. And I think we have very acceptable ways here, nonetheless mind-altering. I had a recent experience where my husband got in a terrible accident, and he was in ICU this summer in Salt Lake City. And I didn't eat or sleep for a few days while he was going through this trauma. And I finally phoned up a doctor in where I'm from, and I said, look, I'm so anxious. I'm about to have a heart attack. What do you suggest? And he said, oh, you should take Xanax. And I discovered that half a Xanax and two glasses of wine will actually get you through anything except a revolving door. But there are plenty of people going around rattling with pharmaceuticals who think that alcohol is a separate kind of drug. It's not. It's just a different way.
So when you look at, as you described in the beginning of the interview, you know, your mother drunk and are rolled in, put into the back of a trunk.
Yeah.
That was just your life? That was your childhood?
Yeah, and you know, I mean, look, it's not... Yes, and I think that, listen, there was my mother is her own weather system, and you combine that with the weather system of a civil war, where as a child, if you're at civil war, you don't realize that peace is a possibility. It doesn't occur to you that no one actually ever thought to sit down and explain to me, you know what, war actually is not the most common state of affairs. There are places in the world where there's peace. I assumed the entire world was at war.
That's the only world you knew.
It was the only world I knew. And I assumed that everybody had a mother like mine. Hmm. And I lived in enough isolation that it wasn't until I got to this country that I realized there were alternatives.
They live in Zambia now, your parents. And this tree of forgetfulness has some deep history, I guess, or deep even mythology.
So in the apparently in the Goba Valley, Mr. Zulu, who was my father's right-hand man, explained to my mother, no, this tree of forgetfulness, there's one in every village. A headman has this tree, and it's the place to which we come and speak to our ancestors, who, of course, are always with us and who are the wisest amongst us since they've been with us the longest. And so you can commune with your ancestors, which my mother was very fond of, especially since her ancestors were, you know, 100% million Scottish Highland blood. But it is also a place to resolve your earthly conflicts. And it is a kind of forgetfulness. And really what I love about that tree, Mr. Zulu explained, no, you can be grown just from a very, very thin cutting. You just take a little cut from a branch and you put it in this earth. I love the image of that, that what was left of my mother by the time they came to this final farm that they're on was a very than cutting of her. It was the core of herself. It was the one thing that war and tragedy and grief had not been able to rob from her, which was her courage. And she planted that courage in this unforgiving soil where there is very little water, where it is hot and inhospitable. And from that, she has flourished into her own kind of forgetfulness, I think, which is a deep acceptance of herself. And that takes courage. Mm.
I'd love to have you read another section from the book, and this is near the very end. I'm passing this across to you. Near the very end of the book, where you're with your parents in their house in Zambia.
Before supper, my parents take the last meal of the day late, like Europeans. Mum makes for her bath with a glass of wine. Dad and I pour ourselves a drink under the tree of forgetfulness and play a languid game of twos and eights. It's not nearly as much fun without Van here to cheat, I say. The dogs split themselves up among laps, beds, and chairs across the camp and begin to lick themselves. From the bathroom, we can hear Mum drowning out Luciani Pavarotti. There's the occasional plop of an inattentive gecko falling from the rafters in the kitchen, where Big H has made a dish of turmeric rice to go with Mum's fish curry bubbling gently in one of the Le Creuset pots. All is as domestically blissful as it can get. Suddenly, the three dogs in the guest cottage start a loud, hysterical chorus of barking. It's been years since I've heard that particular bark, but I recognize it instantly. I put my cards down and look at Dad. That's a snake bark, I say. Dad takes his pipe out of his mouth and cocks his head, listening. Oh, bloody hell, you're right, he says. He hurries up the steps and I follow, hoping to look supportive while also trying to ensure that I don't get to the door first. Dad walks into the guest house. Okay, Bobo, he says, putting up a hand. I look down. He has just stepped over a beautifully patterned snake with a diamond-shaped head as thick as a strong man's forearm. A puff adder. Puff adders kill more people than any other snake on the continent. Their preferred diet is rodents and frogs, of which the Tree of Forgetfulness is an endlessly self-replenishing buffet, and they strike from an S position so that they can hit a target at almost any angle. This one is in an S position now.
And again, I have heart palpitations listening to that. Again, Alexander Fuller reading from the near end of her memoir. Do you ever get used to snakes then? I mean, and I know puff adders are highly dangerous.
Both of my parents live with snakes with an absolute insouciant acceptance. A snake that's even actually more deadly than a puff adder is a black mamba. And there was one that lived in the ceiling of their bedroom at night, and then in the morning it would come up from the ceiling. My dad builds very rickety houses because he just makes them out of sun-baked brick, so they're not exactly water or wildlife proof. And the snake would come out and sunbathe on the tree, and you would need to walk under it to get into their room. But my dad said it's just sunbathing. It's doing what snakes do, and it has no... Who are you to think that the snake has any malintent toward you? He finds it incredibly arrogant that you would think that a snake would even give a moment of its brain power to thinking about you. And my mother says, oh, Bobo, she's American. Yeah, very jumpy about snakes and things.
And you were always called Bobo?
I'm always called Bobo, short for baboon.
Oh.
They're careful not to flatter you, my parents.
And English are always giving their children these
strange
nicknames.
I've done it to my children.
To your own children.
Yeah, I have. And you know, look, it's not a bad thing. It's not a bad thing to have to earn your name. And I think there is a point at which you say, I am Alexandra Fuller. But my parents have made sure that the journey towards that name is one that I have taken myself in my own steps. And it is very spine-stiffening.
You live in Wyoming now.
I do.
Do you feel, and of course, Wyoming is this sort of, unlike Philadelphia, this open openness, mm-hmm. mountains, mm-hmm. huge open fields and prairies.
Mm-hmm.
Does that remind you of Africa?
It does.
Do you get a some of that same sense? Because
yes.
I also sense from you this deep attachment to land.
Yes. I find it very dismembering to be in cities. Not that I don't love it, but I can't sleep. It's the frenetic energy of the place unsettles me enormously. I would get used to it, I'm sure, eventually. But I am almost hallucinating, having spent so many nights in a row in cities, because a kind of deep, peaceful sleep is not something I'm able to achieve without that big sky above me.
And when was the last time you were back in Zambia visiting your parents?
I was back in April. I go back every year. I mean, now that my father's threatening to, you know, kick the bucket at any minute, I go back for a month, which is about the time that it takes for me to settle into the place. I'm constantly surprised by the texture of time when I go home, that it takes on its real meaning, that a day has a full 24 hours, and that each hour is felt for itself as the quality of light and the quality of the sun, the heat, the various animals that sing in chorus. I miss that definition of a day.
Mm. Is there another memoir working on
another
you?
Awful book?
Your mother's words, not mine, but yes. Is there another memoir?
I think that's probably an illegal question.
Meaning that it's just, you're not there yet.
I'm not, yeah. And, you know, the one thing that I have learned is trust, that I now have a faith that the next book that I'm supposed to write will become apparent to me.
Will become apparent to you?
Mm-hmm. It will become, yeah.
As opposed to?
Well, I can't force it. The story will be there when it's ready.
Well, it's been such a pleasure. Thank you so much for joining us today on Radio Times.
Thank you for having me.
You're very welcome. Alexander Fuller's new memoir called Cocktail Hour Under the Tree of Forgetfulness has just been published. And she also wrote another memoir, popular critical success, called Don't Let's Go to the Dogs Tonight. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. And you can check us out on Facebook. In fact, you can see what our guest looks like. You can also check out the archives. And we've got tweets and Twitter and email as well. Kevin Griffin, the engineer for today's edition of Radio Times, and the show is produced by Susan Greenbaum, Patty Leswing, Dennis Devine, and Debbie Builder. I'm Marty Moscow, and thank you so much for joining us.